Thank you for joining us here this morning. This is session 5011, Dreams of a Digitized Humanity and Artificial Intelligence. My name is Bobby Braun, and I'm the Dean of the College of Engineering and Applied Science here at CU Boulder. And it's my pleasure to get to moderate this panel, a panel that is, you know, frankly, going to speak on a topic that is of extreme relevance in our society today, right? The role of machine learning and other, you know, digital forms which are advancing very quickly into our society, both, you know, what are the positive attributes of those, and frankly, what are some of the things we should be concerned about as those technologies advance. We have a very distinguished group of speakers here with us today to talk about this topic. I'm really looking forward to the conversation because this group of speakers is very broad in their extent and in their perspectives of this topic. We're going to have each speaker speak for a few minutes, and we'll go down in this order from your left to right. First speaker is Roger Walton, and he's the General Manager of North and South America of Quantica, a major company involved in machine learning and artificial intelligence in the financial markets. We'll then follow that up with...
We got Ben there, too. Do we have a chair?
Ben,
Ben, did you get a chair?
Yeah, Ben.
Oh, Ben got here.
Come on, Ben. We'll make room for you.
We've got space for you here.
But Ben, you're going to speak third. So, Elliot, slide this way.
All I got to do is
while we hear.
That was easy.
You can have my chair. I'll sit on that stool. So, our second speaker.
Our second microphone.
Our second speaker. Our third microphone. Whichever one I use doesn't work. So much for technology. Our second speaker will be Elliot Pepper. I got it. It's a good thing they're not filming us. Our second speaker will be Elliot Pepper, who is a very prolific novelist, who has written 6 books in 4 years. All of his books factor in the role of technology into society. These are fictional accounts, but rather realistic fictional accounts of machine learning and other artificial intelligence technologies and their role in society. Our third speaker, who I'm very thrilled is here, is Ben Wagner. Wagner?
Wagner.
Wagner, who is an assistant professor. Thank you, Professor Bob. Assistant professor at Vienna University of Economics and Business. And who's an assistant professor at Vienna University of Economics and Business. And our fourth speaker will be Brad Hayes, who's an assistant professor right here at CU Boulder in the College of Engineering and Applied Science. In the Department of Computer Science, and after this session concludes, actually Brad will lead a demonstration that in this same space that starts at the end of this session. And with that, we now have all 4 speakers seated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll kick off the panel with remarks from Roger.
We're going to share the mic the whole time.
I think so. Yeah. That one works best.
Hi. Well, good morning. Is it working?
Yes.
Hello, hello.
You gotta hold it close.
Okay, so I've done a couple of panels. I did some panels last year, and I've done a couple of panels this year as well.
No, it's not working.
It's not working. Is there a sound engineer amongst us?
Let's try this one. Use both.
Hello.
Use both.
Hello. Hello. I think we've got some AI managing stuff at the back there. So I am going to unashamedly
plagiarize some material from probably my very favorite current author, a guy called Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote a book called Sapiens, which is a history of mankind, which talks about the sort of flow and where we've come from as humans, as sapiens, and where we got to. And he's written a second book called Homo Deus, which is all about where we're going. And Homo Deus meaning human God, which is quite frightening. So looking at the title here, The Dreams of a Digitized Humanity, and I think there are lots of dreams, but maybe there might be a couple of nightmares along the way as well. So I'm going to kind of seal some of these materials, so if you've read his book, you're going to recognize some of the messages here. If you haven't read his book, hopefully it's going to give you a bit of insight. But what Harari talks about is the two really, really important things that sapiens were able to do to become this dominant species on the planet. You know, we obviously got this cognitive ability, but it was two things. It was the ability to cooperate and work together in a social order, and that was incredibly powerful. There aren't any other species on the planet that work in the way that we do, with so many people collaborating and cooperating together. And the second thing that we've been able to do, to be able to collaborate, cooperate amongst many thousands, if not millions of people, is to subscribe to what he calls imagined world orders, which are things like law, money, religion, that we've created to kind of allow us to collaborate on that scale. And historically, prayer and hope were our main defense against the three really nasty things that went on in the war, which is famine, plague, and war. And for the first time in history, right now, we're going to see that more people will die of obesity than famine. And just think about that for a second. That's really quite frightening. There are about 3 million people who will die of obesity, and about 1 million will die of famine. We're going to see more people who will die of old age than disease. There are going to be more suicides than there are from terror, from terrorist activities. That's quite frightening. You know, he quotes, McDonald's is a greater threat to our society than ISIS. You are 1,000 times more likely to die of obesity than terrorism. So we're moving now from this, what was a very physical-driven set of industrial revolutions that we've seen, into this advanced technological age, which will be cognitive revolution. And the more, it's all about data. You know, where we are right now, there's a lot of wonderful techniques that's been around for quite some time. AI has been around for many, many years. But what we've got now is the ability to scale like we've never been able to scale before. For AI to be really effective, you need to have huge quantities of data. And now we have that quantity of data in a very economic way, in a very viable way. We can now process untold amounts of data so that AI can really become effective and become a proper viable kind of technique in the world. And we have a wonderful opportunity right now to harness this technology. And it's how we're going to do this. Bill Gates quoted a while ago, we have the ability to free up labour from things like manufacturing and from drudgery and from poor jobs so that we can focus the resource on very human-centric things, on care and health and wonderful kind of positive things. But how are we going to do that? How are we going to be able to harness that? And I come from the data world, and I am exploiting this ability to process this massive amount of data. I feel as though we're doing it in a positive way. How are we going to ensure that it remains positive? How are we going to ensure that these new techniques and these new abilities don't fall into the wrong hands or aren't just exploited in a financial way so that we start to create a superclass? We're going to have massive effects on jobs. There is going to be a dramatic change over the next 20, 30 years that we've never experienced before, the speed of change. And how are we going to do that properly? We don't know where it's going to go. We don't know what it's going to be like. All we know is that these techniques are improving by the minute and by the hour. And what my concern is how we do that properly. Current regulations, current processes to manage this are ineffective. we're not skilled in the right way, our governments are not skilled in the right way, so how are we going to do this? And it's both really, really exciting because of what we can do, but it's both terrifying as well because it falls into the wrong hands. And I'll finish on this one more point. You think about the human genome. That took about 15 years and $3 billion to unravel a few years back. And right now, you can go online, order it, put a bit of spit into a bottle, send it off, and you can get your DNA back in about 3 weeks, and it costs you $200. That's the speed of this technology. You think about how that has changed. And that's really great because now we're able to identify certain predictions around disease based on our DNA sequence. We can find drugs that will only work for me that might not work for Elliot. It's so powerful and so wonderful to be able to do that. But as we start to kind of decode these DNA, and we start to get a more detailed blueprint about where we're going to go, could that be used against us? Could that be used to increase our insurance costs? Could that be used to make certain healthcare propositions very hard for us because it's too expensive to rely? So there's wonderful things, but there's very scary things, and I don't think we're prepared at all, and I mean that dramatically, at all, to manage it properly. And I'm hoping we're going to have an interesting debate to talk about what are the kinds of things that we can do to make that effective and make it much more positive, make it the dream and not the nightmare.
Do you want?
It's the lucky one.
Yeah. So I write science fiction novels, so I guess that, you know, to a certain extent, my job is to come up with new dreams of a digitized humanity. And one of when you try to construct a fictional future, you have to ask weird questions about the present to try to figure out what might make it plausible and what actually makes sense. And you start discovering, like, sort of funny things, and I've actually seen quite a bit of science fiction that I think does a very poor job of sort of extrapolating AI, and it's also, and there's a good reason for it. There's a good reason for this mistake that many science fiction novelists and filmmakers make all the time, is that it makes for great storytelling. And the mistake they're making is they're making all of their AIs conscious. Right, so if you watch The Terminator, like essentially, like we are creating computer programs that eventually become like mirror human intelligence, and I think that that's wonderful for Hollywood because it allows you to personify something that people want to know more about. So it makes for great storytelling, but it actually really misses what I think is an incredibly important and powerful point about machine learning systems. Which is that the whole benefit of having computer intelligence is that it's very different than human intelligence, right? Like, our own intelligence, our own consciousness, I mean, first of all, we don't even have a great definition of what consciousness means for humans. And even if you, like, when you leave this room today, okay, do an exercise for me. So for the rest of the day, when you're walking around and you're not actually actively doing anything, right? So you're not in the middle of a conversation, you're not driving, or maybe you could be driving your car, but when you're sort of in stasis, right? You're just walking around or doing the dishes. Try to take a step back and look at your own thoughts. Like, what are you actually thinking about? And psychologists have done studies on this, and humans spend an enormous amount of time essentially extrapolating social anxieties. Right? I sent that email. Was it I a little too curt? Right? Like, maybe I offended the person on the other end of the line. How am I going to do in my presentation to my boss tomorrow? Like, we spend an enormous amount of our mental capacity doing these things. And that's an example of something that a computer never does, right? And like, that's actually one of the wonderful things about using software. Your machine learning models are never having an existential crisis. And that's actually that's the point, right? That's also the promise of of AI, right?
It's the terrifying part of it as well.
It is, absolutely. But I said it was the terrifying part as well, and we'll get to that. But remember that actually that is a huge promise, and it's promise that we very, very, very quickly acclimatize ourselves to. So I flew here from Oakland, and you know, the first day I was here, my breath was a little short, right? Walking around campus, I'm not used to it, I'm coming from sea level. And we do that all the time in our daily lives with technology. In fact, if you went back to 1991, people were talking about AI then. And if you had a time machine and could go back and bring your phone and show them how Google does search, and it's like automatically knowing what you're typing in and like giving you all of these recommendations that are super spot on right away. I mean, many people in 1991 would have said, oh my God, you guys have AI, right? Like the future has arrived. And now that just seems like obvious, right? It's like, oh yeah, of course I Google it, right? So it's important to pay attention to ourselves, to how we actually perceive the technological advances that we're helping to build. And that like when and sort of the corollary to that is ask questions, right? So if you're reading a news article and it's very scary and it has a great clickbait headline about the future according to AI, you know, take a step back and say like, what when they say AI, what are they actually describing, right? Like, is it this like conscious Terminator that's actually going to come in and just wreak havoc, or are what they describing a better way to create new software algorithms that can help us solve new problems, right? So I think that's an important takeaway, just to keep in mind as you read the news, because you're going to see more and more news about this. And the reason you're going to see more and more news about this is because, you know, cars are computers we drive in, houses are computers we live in, like everything around us, we are turning into a network computer, and that creates massive amounts of data. And I think that the scariest thing about AI, and this is something that I also try to bring to light in my novels, but I think that it's the scariest thing about AI is not that it's going to become conscious and take over the world. It's that whenever you're able to build scalable systems that require immense amounts of data, like there is a natural tendency towards centralization of power, right? We were chatting on the way over in the little cart about how, you know, there aren't that many human organizations on Earth that are really at the bleeding edge of AI research, applied AI research, and most of those organizations are companies you've heard of. They're Google and Amazon and Facebook and a few others, and the reason why they are so dominant in the field is because they have the biggest data pools. Right, so if you're actually doing machine learning, you need such a massive amount of data that it's if you don't have access to that data, you literally can't compete. Right, so I think that the questions that we're going to be struggling with over the next few decades with AI is actually much less about robots taking over the world, although Brad may disagree, but rather, if we build these super effective systems that actually solve a lot of human problems and are extremely useful, how do we make sure that both the benefits of those systems are shared and that they're run fairly, right? Because if you have a lot of centralization, you need to make sure that, you know, humans are actually benefiting from that. So I think I'll leave it there.
Thanks, and apologies again for being late. It would be great if I could blame AI for not being here on time, but sadly it's just my own incompetence to be able to find the building correctly. So I think to build on what we've already heard on for the previous speakers and to think a little bit about the visions that you hear on a day-to-day basis, the ideas, the dreams, the hopes, the beliefs that you're told about when you're told about the future of AI. On the one hand, I understand that it can be incredibly scary and incredibly confusing because there's so many different conflicting predictions of what it might be, what the future is that is coming. On the other hand, it seems to say very much in each individual case about the individual idea of humanity that the person who brings to the table predicts about AI. So I was thinking and listening to Roger's introduction as he made it now. He spent 25 years in the business world, and he's seen all of the changes, all of the beliefs, and all of the hopes. And he's also realized essentially that there's a huge shift in his business world happening and is concerned about the future of the workplace. Now, the reason I'm trying to sort of simplify it and decode it like that is because when you translate what he's just said about the future of work and losing lots of jobs into a empathetic statement about how he sees the world and what his philosophy is, I am concerned that we need workspace, and I am concerned that human beings should find jobs, otherwise this will have a detriment to societies. It makes perfect sense, and it's perfectly obvious. But when translated into sort of a vision of the future, of an idea of which, at this point, AI is attached to so many visions of the future, and so many ideas and so many possibilities, that they're almost endless, and they're meaningless, and they're also in a certain way addictive, because they become reminders of what we would like for the future without any specific technological leanings. And I fully agree with what Eliot has just said. The ideas of consciousness are so absurd because we don't even understand human consciousness, much less artificial consciousness. And so I think one of the main things to remember when you hear the words artificial intelligence is that it's not particularly artificial and it's not very intelligent. So I was on a panel with the lady from Google a few days ago, and she kept pulling faces very uncomfortably when we discussed artificial intelligences developed by different companies. And she used the words that were like dog intelligence or worm intelligence to describe these types of intelligence. And I thought that was quite apt, and I wish that the FCC or a different regulator would force those companies to appropriately describe the intelligence they were using so that they would actually speak about the worm intelligence built into a Tesla or the dog intelligence built into a Google search engine. They're not very advanced systems, and they're certainly not intelligent. The other problem with them is that they're also not particularly artificial. So in the ideas, if you imagine all of these potential visions of the future that are being discussed, so sentient beings and AI will take over and all of these things, what people are actually trying to say is, I hate the world the way it is right now. I really wish it was different. This technology will solve the problem. And what they're expressing in the vision that they translate to the world, to you on TV, or everywhere else in the planet, is that they're trying to express a way in which they think they can solve the world's problems. And here, we get into a field where, again, Eliot is extremely experienced. There is a lot of bad science fiction out of there. And when you see and when you look at those science fiction predictions, what's sad about it is the poverty of the imagination used. We can't imagine a society that we'd actually want, and if we did, we're scared to articulate it. As opposed to being able to say, maybe we don't need technology to solve some of these problems. Because it can't, because it won't, because it's incapable of doing that. And in turn, lots of the issues and challenges we face have nothing to do with technical problems. The fact that we fight wars against each other, the fact that we hate each other, the fact that we can't communicate politically, these are challenges that technology is not going to solve in the next 5 years. And the expectation to do that, the expectation that there will be some magic button solution out there, is in itself part of the problem. And then, if you add on top of that, the artificial part of artificial intelligence is man-made. So there are real human beings, and quite a small club of human beings, with, I hate to say it, extremely impoverished imaginaries of the potential future human race that they would like to create. Because they are recreating the world in their own image. And if we need to be scared of anything, it's their poverty of imagination and their lack of asking us what we would want. That is, a small group of human beings reinventing the world in their own image without outside control. And that is, it's a dream. It's also a slight problem in a democratic sense, in a societal sense. But that is the danger of AI. It's not any technical solution itself. It's the power of the few over the many. And that power to reinforce that very bad science fiction model in a way that they believe is appropriate and in a way which they believe can control and limit and change the problems that they see, which is not necessarily ill-intentioned. It's simply that it's based on their definitions of what the problems are and limited to their potential futures and solutions of what that vision might be. So unless those visions are questioned systematically, and unless we also produce different alternate visions of the future, in a way, when I was listening to what Roger was saying, it was also quite a beautiful picture you were painting, to be honest. I'm not sure it's a bad thing at all that people are dying from obesity than from famine. It means that for one of the first times in human history, we do actually have a choice. We have far more of a choice than we've ever had before over the future of where the world is going. And that's an extraordinarily beautiful thing enabled by technology. We shouldn't pretend that technology has hindered us in getting there. If anything, we now have more of a choice than ever whether we go to McDonald's or not, which is not a choice that somebody has who's starving. So those choices are something that are beautiful and wonderful and amazing, but it also then requires human beings to go out there and take those choices and feel responsible for also making those decisions, and not just accepting somebody else's vision of what the future is going to be, but rather shaping their own and questioning that. There's nothing artificial or intelligent required in the technologies, but so much more in the human beings. Thank you.
That was a fantastic introduction for all of you. I'm going to try to follow this up. So as a professor here, my lab studies human-robot collaboration and collaboration between humans and artificially intelligent autonomous systems. And so just as Elliot was mentioning, he has to envision these future worlds. It's partially my job to help create them and make them real. And I would say that, just to lead off, we are in an incredibly exciting period of transformative change. So we are presently undergoing the fourth major industrial revolution. Right? So we went from steam to electricity, mass production, then to the digital age, and now we're in this age of artificial intelligence and Internet of Things. You might have heard the buzzword Industry 4.0 before. If not, that's what they're talking about. Right? So this, instead of the automation of effort, now we're talking about the automation of reasoning and intelligence. And so I count myself as incredibly fortunate that I'm working in the field that I am now, because I feel it's very, very rare for the future to feel quite so close. And as people talk about artificial intelligence, they usually see these sort of hockey stick-shaped graphs, right, of computing the intelligence and things like this. So there's this widely accepted notion that improvements are going to be coming at an accelerating pace, and we might not be able to keep up. And this could mean really disastrous things for us, particularly if you look at cinema's take on artificial intelligence. That we kind of universally assume that any kind of reasonable artificially intelligent system will say, no humans anymore. That's a terrible idea. And I would agree that that's not really a realistic concern at this point, because in general, artificial intelligence and machine learning really comes down to two problem areas. One is search, right? So can I predict something about the future and plan a path to get there? Or optimization, right? So given some criteria, how can I pick the best thing to do for that? And you can easily come up with a bunch of nightmare scenarios where an optimization is ill-posed, right? And so the machine decides to do something that's counter to our best interests. But I would also argue that that's our problem, right, as the inventors of these systems. So if we introduce automation into the world without giving it the tools that it needs to successfully interact with the world, right, on our terms, that's really our problem. Just as if you're, say, raising a child, and you don't give that child the tools that it needs to interact with the people in the world or the environments that he or she will be present with, then, well, can you really blame the child for not behaving according to your societal norms? And so I would say that as we march forward, right, as into this fourth industrial age, I would say that we're kind of looking over this, overlooking this one really important step, right, where we talk about, okay, so humans are doing all of this intelligent work now, and then tomorrow we're going to have robots and computers doing all of this stuff. And that's generally just not the case. In particular, my lab's research is on human-robot collaboration, human-AI collaboration. So you have a human and an intelligent system working together for these goals. So back in the late 90s, when IBM introduced Deep Blue, right, and it beat Garry Kasparov, right, that didn't necessarily tell us a whole lot about human intelligence. Right? That certainly didn't tell us very much about anything other than maybe chess isn't that exciting of a game to a computer as we initially thought it was. And people were thinking, oh, is chess dead because of this, right? So we have computers now, or we have programs now that can beat the best humans at chess. Well, no, we didn't stop there, because it turned out that a human paired with Deep Blue was able to beat Deep Blue, right? So that suggests that there's still something missing there. So we might have an optimization. Deep Blue runs it very well, right? But there's something missing that human insight is able to still provide to it. And so a lot of the problems that we face, even though we might be able to get some objectively more efficient solution by throwing it into some machine learning algorithm and looking at what it says, it doesn't mean that the human aspect of this work is irrelevant, useless, or any of these sort of negative characteristics that gets attached to it. Now, I would say that we do have a big problem with over-reliance on some on artificially intelligent or seemingly artificially intelligent technologies, right? So Tesla's autopilot, sure, they called it autopilot. That might not have been the best move in terms of establishing reasonable expectations, but the car is very clear about when you should or should not trust it, and a lot of people still ignore these things, right? And so there's also this very fundamental human problem of, well, we don't really believe the warnings from the systems that we're creating. And I think that says more about us than really the systems themselves. And so I would actually just push back a bit on the notion that, you know, these systems aren't intelligent and they aren't artificial, because I would say, well, how are we going to define intelligent? There's a tendency to kind of imagine intelligence as just beyond understanding. So if you can look at a system and you fully understand how it works, surely that's not intelligent. You can specify all of the rules for that. So you end up with this very murky category. Well, what are we actually going to call something that's intelligent? And I think with that, we'll go back and get some questions. Thanks.
You want to get that one?
I need the mic. Nope. All the way up.
That's such an intelligent crisis. First of all, thanks to all our speakers for those opening remarks, which were, you know, spot on, fantastic, and presented a diverse range of views on this topic. We're going to move to a question and answer session, more of a discussion with you, with the audience. Before I turn to audience questions, I want to mention quickly that the Conference of World Affairs is in the midst of its 70th crowdfunding campaign. And to celebrate our 70th year, we set a goal to raise $70,000 through this crowdfunding campaign. And those funds would be used to continue to put on this workshop, this conference in future years. The conference is about half the way towards its goal at this time, and we really appreciate your support. Any amount would help. And you can give to the crowdfunding campaign by selecting the donate button. You can tell them, donate button in your app. Those of you that have the app on your phone, or you can just visit the CWA website later on. We are going to move to questions, and there's two ways for you to submit questions. Actually, quite a few of you already have through the app. I've got a list here of questions already. You're welcome to find me in the app and continue to submit questions that way. And, you know, since this is a session on digitized humanity, I imagine I'll get a lot of questions this way. But it's not necessary for you to submit questions through the app. If you're more comfortable, we do have note cards being passed around along the aisles. And if you'd like to write down a question on a note card, it will be brought up here, and I'll sort through them along with these as we go through the questions. One last point on the questions. I'd really like to call out if a question comes from a student. So if you're a student posing a question, please start the question with word student, you know, dash, and then the rest of your question. It would also help me a great deal if you didn't write a novel in submitting your question, but, you know, made it brief and to the point. So as I said, there have been a number of questions submitted already. The first one actually came right in the midst of Roger's opening remarks. Oh, wow. And so by being first, we'll start with this question. The question is, Roger mentioned how DNA tests could conceivably be used by insurance companies against us. And the question then says, isn't that info available to them already via blood tests, et cetera, that are part of normal health care? So perhaps, Roger, you could expand on that concern.
And yes, there are some pretty good controls over medical data right now.
And I'm not talking about what exists right now. I'm talking about the complete unraveling of your own personal DNA, which they don't have right now. They've got certain things from your blood tests, but they don't completely unravel your personal DNA. Well, I hope they don't. Maybe they do. It's where it might go. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about what is existing right now. And so my fear, you know, we've all seen what's happening to data getting into the wrong hands, and we've all seen what happens when the data that we willingly put out there is used against us. You know, we all know Cambridge Analytica. You know, that is, I think, a terrifying scenario where our own data that we're willing to share is affecting our own democratic process. I think we need to be really careful about that. So it's about the responsibility. And I think, you know, picking up on some of the things that the guys have said here, I think it's the inability to be able to recreate sentiment or emotion or care from an AI perspective that is the fear. You know, you think about, we've all got credit ratings. You know, those are largely automated. They're kind of pulling data from all sorts of different sources and they create a credit score for you. What happens if that's influenced in the wrong way? And you are in this automated process and you can't get out of it because you don't know how to challenge it, and nor do the credit rating agencies know how to respond to your challenges, because there isn't the care, there isn't that sort of human element associated with the process. And that's what I'm talking about, the fear of AI, is because it is very much a data, an emotionless data process that I think we just need to be careful about. Think about how, you know, we construct roads, and if there happens to be an anthill in the way, you know, we don't hate ants, but it goes. If we start to relinquish too much control over the automation of the process through data, then, you know, you can build a computer that is, all its own purpose in life is to calculate pi to an infinite number of decimal places. All that will do is just continue to do that and will destroy everything in its path. It sounds scientific, but because it doesn't care, it doesn't have that ability to kind of make the right decisions. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of fear. So it's how do we really prepare for it? And my issue is that we're not prepared for it. We are sleepwalking into oblivion if we're not careful. This technology will grow. This technology will be dramatic, and it will grow much faster than we've ever seen over the next 30 years than we have before. You know, you think about a child entering into school right now, into first grade. We have absolutely no idea what to teach them. We don't know what the world is going to be like in 20 to 30 years. We teach by inertia and by momentum, because that's what we've already done. So it's all about now how we educate ourselves as children, as adults, to be responsible, to understand what this means, to understand what's happening with our data, to understand what may occur in the future. And we're back to the kind of, you know, the unraveling of our DNA. What is going to happen to that, and how do we manage it for the good and not for the bad? And all I'm saying is that we're not prepared, we don't have a process in place to do that.
Can I throw something
in
there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Whoops, there we go. So I just wanted to call out the fact that you mentioned Cambridge Analytica, and obviously Zuckerberg's been in the news this week. But what's happened with Facebook and the 2016 election, and actually also many examples, but after the 2016 election, is actually a great example of Brad's optimization problem. So if you look at Google, right, you know, at the very high level, when you search for something on Google, they're trying to optimize for relevance. And what do people do as soon as they see a system that's trying to optimize for relevance? Well, if you want to get your site to be number one when somebody searches for something, you do what's called search engine optimization, right? So you try to reverse engineer how Google decides what comes first so that your site will come up earlier than it should. This is a hard problem to solve because there are always bad actors trying to cheat every system. So you have to design systems in such a way that they are strong in the face of bad actors trying to cheat them. And Google's actually done a pretty good job. I mean, like, they've made many mistakes, and you've probably noticed in your own searches over the years that sometimes there were some pretty weird or not very useful things coming up early in the search. You know, they had a number of funny examples very early on. You know, O'Reilly Auto Parts, like that company. Okay, some of you may have heard of Tim O'Reilly, who is a big sort of like tech industry like entrepreneur. And when when people searched for the word O'Reilly, because Tim O'Reilly had tons, he had been on the internet since the internet was a thing. He was really high in the search results, even if you were searching for auto parts. Right, so that was actually a big problem that Google struggled with early on. And the way that they have solved these problems over the years is by adding more variables. So they look at many different factors, not just ranking links, to decide what comes first, what comes second, what comes third. And right now, like when we use it, it works quite well. They use the same principle for spam in your email inbox, which, you know, spam was like, there were many people saying in the early noughts that basically spam would make email unusable, right? That like you actually, that won't be a thing anymore because it's too much of a problem. So you can start to solve these optimization problems. The interesting thing with Facebook is that they have oriented all of their internal development towards optimizing for engagement, right? Which means they want to keep you in the app. They're not like Google, where the whole point is to get you out of Google search and answer your question. Facebook's goal is to keep you in the app so it remains entertaining. And this is where the optimization problem comes in, right? We learn more about ourselves, when we see the results of a broken system, sometimes than the system itself. Because it turns out that we are very, very engaged by things that might not be true. Right, and so this is a huge mess, obviously, for Facebook at the moment. But it is also important to remember that you can make improvements to that. Right, like I'm sure Facebook has many internal teams freaking out right now, trying to do the same thing that Google does to fight SEO optimizers. Right, like to say, okay, how can we try to, is there a way that we can rebalance this algorithm to avoid these kinds of outcomes in future? It's not that we should trust them to do that, right? I mean, the more pressure, the better to get it right. But it's just important to remember that we go through cycles like this all the time.
We're going to go to the next question. We're getting quite a few. So one other question from the app here is that several of you touched on already. The question is, are machines being programmed to mimic the emotional intelligence of people? That's such a strong determinant of human perception. That is, will machines ever mimic the enormous diversity of human mind maps that dominate our awareness and our decision-making?
Maybe throw it over that end.
Throw it to that side.
Sure. Thank you. So that's a great question, and that's actually something that my lab is working on actively. Again, when you think about collaborating with somebody, if you show up to work and one of your coworkers shows up and they are visibly upset, they seem like they're just at the brink of breaking down, you're probably going to treat them a little bit differently than if they just walked in normally, like a typical day. And so there's no reason to expect that. We wouldn't want that same kind of awareness, right, in the autonomous systems that we interact with. Now, to the question of will we ever have this, I think the answer is overwhelmingly yes, we'll probably get there. How quickly we'll get there is kind of an unknown, but I think that's a very important thing for us to include in our design optimization here for these kinds of systems. Right? Like, we interact with technology all the time, and generally speaking, the current state of the art is that the human bends to the technology as well. You will adapt to the program that you're using. You'll learn that interface, even if it wasn't initially intuitive to you. And so it only stands to reason that as we get better at designing these things, and as the systems that we build become more and more complex, we would want them to also share in that co-adaptive process with us. So yeah, I think this is something that's very, very important for these systems to have, and we're working on it.
Maybe just to build on that, I think, so on the other side of how humans respond to machines and not how machines respond to us, we're very, very used to putting the idea of sentience or conscience into things that are not animals or human beings. So if you give a child a cuddly toy, go away and start talking to it and give it a name, the same thing goes to, there are many examples in the caring industry of very simple sort of Tamagotchi-style toys that have very simple but very cute features that are given to people because there's not enough space essentially to care for old people. And old people will end up loving these things. They're not particularly intelligent, but they have beautiful eyes and they interact with them in a way that makes them feel very comfortable. These are the sorts of interactions that we'll start seeing that will become increasingly common, and they don't require a high degree of intelligence. Instead, they focus on taking existing psychological traits that we have. So there's very well known in psychology the specific way in which the eye-nose ratio, the nose-ear ratio, and the way the features are split, large eyes. If you've seen any cat in an animated Hollywood film, these are exactly the sorts of cats that are animated in a way so you think they look cute, and you can equally apply this to a product development. It doesn't have to be hugely complex, because we are, as human beings, to a certain degree, also have a psychology that can be manipulated, and the way you can press certain buttons to get people to respond to certain things. And that's good if it happens in a benevolent sense. That's not so good when it happens in a less benevolent sense. So there are also a lot of televisions right now which are being used with the inbuilt cameras to survey their audiences and to basically find out when they are smiling, when they are happy, and when the microphone is going on and off while I'm talking.
Try that one.
Try this one.
Literally, yep. It was while I had it in the second.
I think the battery's on. Well.
So
I guess that was the time limit.
That's our time limit. I have a little machine learning algorithm.
So if I were to now take the sentient understanding of this machine, I would just say that the machine doesn't like me. So it's very possible to do that, and it does make sense. We do that all the time just to make sense of very complex systems. The challenge is when they become manipulative. So there are lots of systems now that are used to take pictures of individuals and basically to see whether they're smiling or not, to work out whether they like the adverts or microphones being surreptitiously turned on by Android apps to see whether people are having happy or sad conversations about the TV app they're watching. These are also forms of sentiment analysis, and they will become increasingly common simply to create additional data points to send you things. So in the interaction, I think it's key. I love the example that you're using, because it's very much about the interaction between human and machine. It's not about the AI going off and doing something on its own. It's not about the human being lost in this crazy world. It's very much about how machine and human being together interact to produce something new and different. And in the context of that, because you pushed back a little bit before, and I think I understand where you're coming from, I see, and I'm also frustrated, but I also work in the computer science department, and I'm also frustrated when users do silly things with the technology that I don't expect. What is interesting for me is that there's, and I don't think you're saying this, but there are lots of, there's a stream in computer science as well, which very much focuses on blaming the user. So there's this idea that if the user does something stupid or unexpected, well, they should have read the manual. And if they didn't read the manual, they should have at least understood what was going on because it was obvious, right? And if it wasn't obvious, well, they're still to blame. And specifically in the context of when we're talking about so-called self-driving cars, I don't really care whether you have a manual for that or not. If you call it an autopilot, you have to stand by that. And if then there's a manual afterwards, it's a small print, by the way, actually you're responsible for everything you do at all times, so please take responsibility for the computer you don't understand. That's fine. That's okay, but we don't have to accept that as a scientist. We don't have to say that's a reasonable way either of marketing that or of informing your users that they might die on the way. And what we're doing is we're creating lots of systems where we put human beings into a place where precisely this form of human-computer interaction doesn't work so well for the human being. Because we're expecting things of human cognizance, of human ability to concentrate, of oversight of AI systems that they essentially don't understand and can't understand. They don't have the tools to. Which are unreasonable. And in these situations where that is in place, we need a more human-centric understanding of technology that really focuses on what can human beings do. They cannot focus 4 hours on a system they are not in control of and then suddenly jump in and magically control the AI. So in that context, it's silly to have that expectation. And rather than saying, blame the user, we need to get past blaming the user and build systems where the user can't be blamed because there's nothing they can do wrong. That's a good system, and those are the systems we should be striving towards, rather than finding ways in which, for sure, they can be gamed or manipulated, that's one thing, but just systems that fall apart every half a mile or 0.8 miles, like in the case of this automated self-driving system, and the mic still doesn't like me, that won't be sufficient. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Nothing here. Okay. The next question is actually from a student, and it relates to jobs in this new industry. And the question basically asks, will AI create a large swath of new jobs for people, or will it take away jobs that people have today?
Would you like to take that first? Yeah, I think...
You gotta hold it really close. No, this one works.
Hello? Really close. Hello? No, it's not working. I'll just shout.
Shout.
We're gonna go manual. I don't know if anyone saw some of the panels that I've been on before. This is my biggest fear. And I think we can sit here, we're all pretty well educated here, I think we're all somewhat privileged. And we can fight and we can manage the technology that's coming. What I'm really concerned about are those that don't have that capability. We're talking millions and millions of jobs that are going to be displaced. And we have no track record in being able to protect those jobs or find things for these people to do, because there aren't going to be the new jobs. On the past three industrial revolutions we've had, there have been new jobs that have come about. And there is no evidence that we're going to see an increase in numbers of jobs to replace these jobs. And we're talking about middle-ranking, educated jobs that are going. We're talking about people that are working in knowledge classes, that they are doing stuff that makes sense, they're using their minds. So it's not just manual labour. These are educated people that are going to be displaced. And my concern is that we're not prepared for this, and we're not doing anything to be able to protect ourselves and prepare for the future. And I think this is what we need to be careful about. Sorry.
No, good. You're right. I want to try to make it more of a discussion.
Here, sure. I'll throw one in. So
see if you can make this work while you're throwing it in.
Can I make it work?
Oh,
all right. Okay, so to make this more of a discussion, I'll play devil's advocate here a little bit. So I think that I would say that probably 99% of the people in this room have a job today that would be totally unrecognizable to someone from the 18th century,
right?
Now we're going now. We have gone through technological revolutions before, and this has actually always been a concern. If you shod horses for a living, when the internal combustion engine became a thing, your job no longer existed, right? On the other hand, that didn't mean that there was no more work to do. We needed a whole new class of mechanics in every single town to service those complicated new machines that everybody was getting around in. I don't think my career path would have been possible 50 years ago. And that's in large part because I have new tools at my disposal to create a new job, right? We've talked about this a little bit in previous panels, but I really do think that the way to think about how AI is going to impact employment is that we have a ton of work to do in the world, and work needing to be done is very different from like what we call our professions today. So there are definitely, just like there are very few jobs for typists left today, if you are a financial analyst, you are already being displaced, right, by software. And that means that you now have the opportunity to invent a new job for yourself. The last point, the closer there, is that that transition is always really, really difficult. You mentioned that we are in the fourth major technological revolution in human history. Those revolutions are extremely painful for billions of people, right? right, in today's world. And at the turn of the 20th century, or of the 19th century, we had to come together to make extraordinary political and social institutional changes in order to adapt to that new world, right? That's when we invented the weekend and the 40-hour work week and all of these things that we now take for granted never existed before.
I just want one footnote. The issue we've got is it's the pace by which this change is going to occur, and that's what we have no experience of, and that's what I'm concerned about. It's the pace.
And I think it's very easy to agree with that. I think that the challenge is that we don't know how many jobs will be.
Is that one?
This one.
Okay.
Give me that one back. You guys keep breaking them.
So we don't. Okay, come on.
Put it very close to
you. Yeah, I'm eating it. I'm literally eating it. Okay, if I hold it up, it works.
It's got to be very close. It's got to be touching your lips.
Touching my lips like this.
I give up.
Okay, so we don't know. We don't actually know. We're guessing.
Right.
And if you look at the previous transitions, I think it's more important not to focus on unemployment or the lack of jobs, but to focus on inequality and what
right.
type of jobs.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So if you look at the people who are losing their jobs now, they may be quite good or at least reasonable level jobs, which you can earn something from, yeah. as opposed to the future jobs, which will be much lower skilled jobs, which will be basically robotic-like, sort of simple, stupid jobs that are sort of interacting with that, or very high-level jobs. There's not a lot in between. And it's this in-between jobs going missing that basically means it's very classic. It also happens at the beginning of the 20th century. You see the same thing. The response to that, I hate to say it because it's not very popular in the US, the response to that around the world was different forms of socialism. It was building institutions to look after those middle people and reskill them, give them enough time to get back into a higher paid job rather than being stuck in a lower paid job or no job long term. And so those institutions, we won't build them overnight, but if you want to respond to that, it's the usual, it's the same stuff that we've always done, which is education, which is understanding that. I'm not quite sure, also I agree with Roger's point before where he mentioned that we don't know what to teach somebody now who's going into first grade. We do know, and we've always known it, it's always been the same thing. It's not to teach them to get a job, it's to teach them how to learn. And if we teach people properly, which isn't happening in many parts, I fully agree, but if you teach people properly, that's held true for hundreds and hundreds of years. But it is still difficult. It's not comfortable when you have to go to somebody in their early 50s and say, you need to completely retrain now, spend 4 years retraining, earn a bad wage, not be able to look after your family, and then you'll maybe get the job you had 5 years ago. That's not a nice thing to say. That's socially extremely uncomfortable. But the problem with that is not so much the technical problem, it's catching those people and giving them a pathway out of the situation they're in rather than being stuck in a shitty job.
That's great. That's great. Thank you.
The microphone agrees too.
The microphone's on. So while the microphone's sort of on, next question comes from a student.
Keep it up. Just shout.
Yeah, just shout.
What positive images going forward do you have for artificial intelligence? What can we say will move society forward in a positive sense from this revolution? Brad, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, so...
Shout.
Yeah, fine. So I remain very optimistic about artificial intelligence in general. And I would say that some of the positive things that are going to come from this, right, are it's going to enable people to do things that they couldn't before, right? Or it's going to enable people to do things more safely than they could before. And these kinds of things, they could be abused, right? Almost any technology, given sufficient determination, can be abused. And humans are great at this. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do these things, right? Because in this case, I genuinely feel that the pros significantly outweigh the cons for this. And actually, even just jumping back to the first question that we got about, what happens if your insurance company gets access to, say, your genome? And I would argue that rather than... sure, we should look at privacy concerns and whatnot, but maybe that also should spur a deeper conversation about maybe changing our expectations for really how, say, insurance works then, right? If this kind of information is there and it can be abused or can be leaked out there. And so I think that this is going to be, again, a transformative change to society. And even relating it to the jobs question, it's really hard for us to even now say what those new jobs are going to be. Other than the answer is yes, it's going to change the jobs landscape quite a bit. Yes, there's going to be a lot of struggle in the near term as we figure that out. But once we get these new tools to a level of maturity, I think it's irresponsible to say that we won't find some way to exploit that for our own betterment.
I mean, I think AI is amazing. Like, it is incredible the miracles that we are bored with today, right? You know, like, it's incredible. I mean, here's a really banal example. My first book was set in Boulder, but I lived in California, right? When you're writing a novel, you need to actually, like, figure out what things look like. I'd visited Boulder, but I wanted to have the characters, like, go to a local coffee shop and stuff like that. In the past, I would have had to fly here, walk around, maybe take pictures, take notes, do all of that kind of stuff. I had visited before, but I had done none of that in-depth, you know, note-taking because I hadn't been planning on writing the book. Now, I went on Yelp, and people had posted pictures of, you know, many of the local cafes and written about what they ate there and all that kind of stuff. I was able to use that in the book in a way I never wouldn't have been able to do without being augmented by the internet, right? And like that's what chess players are able to do when they're working with computers to beat computers, right? I mean, I think it's really like for all the doom and gloom that's easy to spin in these kinds of conversations because it's interesting and we're worried. I mean, it is incredible what we have already been able to achieve with computers and like. It is almost like mind-boggling how cool the problems we're going to be able to solve in the future are.
All right, let's go to the next question. That's great. From a student, and the question reads, Brad, thank you for bringing up Deep Blue, which was a great example of augmented intelligence and the potential of this technology. Particularly the potential of this technology working, you know, with humans. And so the question is, to what extent will augmented intelligence be crucial to solving global issues and global problems? And what kind of problems do you see it being applied to other than just chess?
Sure, that's a great question. And so I would say that generally, the idea, especially the idea within my own lab's work, is that if you have a human and a machine working together, you can create a team that's greater than the sum of its parts. Right? And somebody had mentioned earlier that, well, there's a certain subset of things that computers are really, really good at. And then there's another set of things that humans are really good at, right? So exercising judgment and foresight. So if you're, for example, training your machine learning algorithm how to drive a car, your machine learning algorithm might need to crash that car to figure out not to drive off of a bridge. But a human, right, we give these signals to each other constantly. If you were learning how to drive with a parent or somebody else in the passenger seat, when you do something that's maybe not great, they grip into the armrest and they give you all this kind of signaling because they can engage some kind of foresight, right, that maybe is inaccessible to these automation components. So in beyond chess, I mean, there are a lot of really good problems out there that computers are really good at providing at least a sort of a search aid, right? So in the chess problem, the machine might be able to search deeper than the human can, so more positions ahead. Well, we can use computer models to solve all kinds of logistics problems, right? To do these massive, massive scheduling and planning problems, so say how to deliver food aid around the world, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that the computer is going to be able to solve that problem. There are all kinds of factors that we aren't going to be able, at least in any kind of near term, to encode into those kinds of optimizations. And that's really where the human element comes in, is being able to use that as a tool to expand their own cognitive capability. And we already have some examples of this, but I think it's only going to get more and more important as time goes on.
Roger is a good example of this, actually. Like,
what, in terms of what I do? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important that we don't create too much alarm, because I think the opportunity we have, that's what I said at the beginning, we have the opportunity to harness this technology and make our lives so much better. Like Elliot says, we can remove so many boring, horrible jobs if we do this right. What I'm concerned about is how we kind of care and we cope and we educate people to kind of move with the pace. But yeah, in terms of what I do, I mean, we analyze huge quantities of data. We look for transactions and movement of funds all around the world to look for money laundering. Right now, between 3 and 5% of global GDP is laundered money. It's criminal money. This is trillions of dollars of bad money, drug money, human trafficking, child pornography, really nasty, horrible stuff that is going on. And we have to try and stop this right now. And we're not doing enough. Hopefully, with the kind of technology that we use and other people that are following the same paths, we're on the road to trying to stamp that out, which is a really positive thing. I think that's a fabulous thing to be able to do. So there's really cool stuff that we can take advantage of with this technology. I just think we need to be careful about, we don't know where it's going to go. We need a new way of looking at it to ensure that it goes in the positive way.
Okay, great, thank you. We're running short on time, but we can do a couple more questions. This is a nice one from a student. If you were a 16-year-old kid, thinking about your future, what would you study? What technologies would you go into? What courses would you take? What would you recommend for this new world?
Philosophy.
Philosophy.
That's a good one.
Humanities is certainly part of it. Anyone else?
I would also strongly suggest studying design or something design-related.
Design?
Because I think at the moment we're really, in all technologies, we tend to overestimate in the short term the impact they'll have and underestimate it in the long term. So while we're talking about AI now and all of these wonderful new developments that we could be having, there's a very big challenge, which is, why are the four or five of us even sitting here? Like, why did we fly here to speak to you rather than, as you've already heard from Elliot and other examples that we've heard at, we could just also be virtual projections sitting here talking to you. The main reason that we have so much air travel at the moment is because we're put in situations where bosses expect you to be in the office at a certain period of time in a certain way. Conference attendees expect us to be sitting here physically, otherwise you wouldn't be in the room. So we have these amazing technologies already that could allow us to do all sorts of amazing things, but we're not using them. And so I think design and designing ways in which this becomes a cool thing that you would want to attend, even if it still means coming to this lecture hall, but we aren't flown in from around the world, would already change the way in many different ways. And as AI will then be sort of the step on top of that, but we already have so many things that if we were using them properly, we could really reshape the world we live in, but it's the interaction between the machine and the human being. We haven't got there yet. We're not fully using the potential of many things we have already, let alone of AI.
So just to add to that really quickly, I would actually go back to something Ben said a few minutes ago, which is like focus on learning how to learn. Right, because like that's the one thing that really will never become irrelevant, and I would understand that if I was 16 and in this audience, that might be a confusing thing to hear, right? Because it's like, well, what does that really mean? Come on, right? Like that sounds more like philosophy than like actual practical life advice. But I can give you one tip for trying to figure out what that means and actually applying it in your own life. The way that I try to do it is, you know that feeling you have when you're in a class that's maybe on a new subject for the first time and it's intellectually uncomfortable, right? It's sort of like you don't know what anything is about, and so you're just trying to like grasp onto a few things and make sense of it for yourself. And then when you take you go back to the next day at the class, the next day, eventually you get comfortable, you know the big ideas that people are talking about. That feels pretty similar to like getting off the plane in a foreign country where you don't speak the language, right? You're trying to like engage with a new subject at first blush. So seek out that source of discomfort. Hmm. Like I always try to optimize for discomfort in my own learning. Because I know the more I have to challenge myself to figure out how something works, even though it's uncomfortable, that's actually where the best returns come in terms of insight into my own life.
Yeah, so if I could just very briefly add to that, I agree with everything that was said thus far, particularly with respect to learning how to learn. Really, operationally, that means push yourself onto topics that are unfamiliar or uncomfortable to you. Learning is really hard. Learning can be really painful, and really the only thing that separates somebody who eventually achieves the knowledge of these various topics is somebody who's stuck with it, right? And recognizing that this isn't just hard for you. This is hard for everybody, and it takes a lot of determination and willpower and patience to get through it. If anybody is particularly interested in the artificial intelligence, I encourage you to email me outside the panel. I have lots and lots of recommendations. But more importantly...
A little plug there.
Yeah. But more importantly, it has never been easier to get access to a curriculum to educate yourself on pretty much any topic. And I would say the most important thing isn't which topic, it's just that you keep doing it.
All right.
Yeah, that's great.
Your email address.
Yeah, it should be...
it's online.
You can just search for my name.
Brad Hayes. Computer science, CU Boulder.
Yeah.
So,
we'll just sit outside his office for half an hour. It'll work.
Last question, this is for each of you, and you each have 1 minute to answer. Let me be very clear: 1 minute or less. What's your prediction for AI in the future? 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, where will we as a society be with this technology? We'll just go down the line. 1 minute.
Well, 1 minute. And I think we, like I said before, we have the opportunity to harness it in a positive way and utilize its power and its capability to analyze massive amounts of data for our benefit. I don't think we know what's going to happen in the next 5 years, or certainly don't in the next 10 years or in the 15 years. It's about, we've talked a lot about techniques, we've talked a lot about what things could be done. We don't know where this is going to go, and more importantly, it's how it's influenced by whom. We talked a little bit about SEO optimization, search engine optimization. You can pay Google to get to the top of the tree. So money speaks, and I think we just have to be a little bit careful to ensure that it's fair. Otherwise, we're going to have a more polarization of wealth than we've ever seen before. So it's all about the ability to regulate properly, to enhance, to support, and to promote, but to regulate properly and make sure the technology goes in the way. But I don't think we know.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that the best way to build a better future is to focus on solving real problems in the present, right? Nobody really knows. If I knew how to predict anything, I'd probably be a billionaire. Right? I mean, so I think it's like I can't make a concrete prediction for what the world will look like in 5 years, but I don't really care what the world looks like in 5 years. What I do care about is that we try to make the world better, right? Like that's my goal. And that's something that we can act on today and use every tool at your disposal. Identify people who are suffering from a problem and how can you solve it? You can solve it with AI. You can solve it by improving and strengthening our social institutions. You can solve it with every tool at your disposal. So, yeah, to build a better future, solve problems today.
Ben?
So I think 10 years from now, we'll be sitting here. Ten years from now, we'll be sitting in this room in another conference from World Affairs on the topic of AI, and we'll be asking ourselves how we missed the boat.
Yeah, that's a good one.
This panel will look completely different. We won't all be male. We will be from all corners of the world, and they will be the leading AI experts from around the world telling us how we had those great ideas 10 years ago, and then we forgot about it, didn't do anything about it, and then other countries shot ahead. The country that is investing most amounts of money in artificial intelligence research and development right now is China. They want to become the global lead by 2025. Lots of other countries are doing the same. And the challenge for us is not to get left behind in all of that while ensuring that we take all of the institutions, all of the things we've learned about society, and put them into that. Because otherwise we'll be faced by AI that we don't want, that we don't like, and that will look very different from the way our societies look right now.
Great. Yep. Thank you. Brad?
Okay, so in 1 minute, I would say that within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see AI bring about a lot of convenience, and then I think there's going to likely be some grave example of over-reliance that will lead to very strict regulation. We're already seeing a lot of proposed regulations in the EU on artificial intelligence, say, mandating that these systems be explainable, right? That a human can ask questions of these systems and get answers that we can reason over and understand. And I think in 20 years, it's really hard to predict, other than if we do our jobs right, there will be some large transformation in society, at least on this scale, if not greater than the smartphone, right? So 20 years ago, we wouldn't really be talking too much about the promise that smartphones are necessarily going to hold. But here we are, right? And we have at least three of them on the table right now. So yeah, so I would say like 20 years transformative change if everything goes to plan, but along the way, it's likely that there's going to be some kind of disaster that leads to a more formal role being played by society in monitoring and regulating these systems.
All right. Thank you. So let's thank our speakers, please. Thank you all. Very good.